She's writing poems about socialism, and she's also writing an advice column for socialist middle-class women. And and she gains notoriety here because she pens this really famous front-page editorial during the general strike in 19 that seemed to call for revolution.
On today's show, we'll find out about the life and work of Anna Louise Strong, a 20th century American journalist, activist, and supporter of the labor movement. Connor Casey, labor archivist at the University of Washington Labor Archives, talked with Mike Dumovich on the We Do the Work radio show.
They imposed their self-discipline on the entire mill workforce, including those that weren't in the mill. Because of that, they were a direct threat to Andrew Carnegie and Henry Clay Frick and the people who ran the mill.
That's steelworker Mike Stout, who's got a new book out, The Homestead Steel Mill, The Final 10 Years. Mike took a deep dive into the history of unions and their struggles at the mill on a recent edition of the Heartland Labor Forum radio show.
One question is, why do people not know U.S. labor history? And then I think, to the extent that we do know U.S. labor history, we tend to romanticize it and oversimplify it. And so the other question is, where did labor go wrong? What can we learn from the past?
Historian Max Krochmal unpacked these questions and more in a wide-ranging discussion with Gene Lance on the Workers' Beat radio show recently. And as always, we wrap up this week's show with labor history in two.
It was a union-busting maneuver against the United Teachers of New Orleans, the first integrated education union in the South. Its membership overwhelmingly consisted of African-American women.
Rick Smith tells us about the day New Orleans fired 7,000 teachers. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. Here's the show. Without us.
This is Mike Dumovich, the old crow, bringing you another segment of We Do the Work we like to call Learn Yourself, a program dedicated to bring life to an event or an individual that has made a positive impact on the lives of workers and the labor movement. And we hope to stimulate your interest and direct you to resources so that you might learn yourself. And once we begin, we call on the articulate archivist, Connor Casey, the University of Washington Labor Library, who will tell us about Anna Louise Strong and Irene Hull, who, in different generations, moved tirelessly to improve the lives of Northwest workers. Welcome, Connor.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to be back here.
When I asked you to discuss women in the labor movement, you chose the stories of two very remarkable women, Anna Louise Strong, who made significant contributions to the Seattle General Strike in 1919, and Irene Hull, who installed insulation in ships in Vancouver, Washington in 1942 and founded the Coalition of Labor Union Women in 1974 and died at the age of 98 in Seattle in 2011, having never missed a monthly coalition meeting. Both were women of courage, determination, and humanity. Important lives well lived. So, who was Anna Louise Strong?
Well, Anna Louise Strong was a radical journalist, an author, an activist, and a pacifist, and actually a recalled Seattle school board member. And she's also a memoirist who lived in the early part of the 20th century. She was born in 1885 in Nebraska, and her father was a minister, sort of a social gospel minister for the Congregational Church. So she grew up in kind of a progressive household. She early on tried to apply the themes of Christianity and social justice, and this kind of informed her later career and her education. She was also extremely smart and gifted, which we can get into later.
So how did she become involved in the union movement?
Well, that's actually kind of a long story. It's really interesting. So she actually came to Seattle because of its political climate, which at the time, as in some ways it is now, was pro-labor and progressive. First of all, the way she becomes involved with the labor movement probably predates this, but she became a Seattle school board member in 1916 and won this landslide victory with the support of women's group and organized labor. So there's this really solid link there. At the time, she was also the only female school board member. And she had this kind of broad social vision, which is one of the reasons why organized labor supported her. She argued that public schools should offer social service programs for poor children and that they should also serve as community centers. Now, the way she actually comes to Seattle is pretty interesting. As I mentioned, she was a very precocious and smart student from very early on. So she graduates from Bryn Mawr College and then goes to Oberlin and finally gets a PhD in philosophy at the University of Chicago, all by the time she's 23 years old. And after that, she becomes a child welfare advocate and makes this traveling exhibit. She works with the United States Education Office. And so the exhibit tours the U.S. and other countries. And the exhibit brings in more than 6,000 people today during its run in Seattle.
What year was that?
This is around 1910 or so.
Okay.
So you see, she's got these themes of trying to do advocacy work, social justice, education as a mechanism for that. And so when she comes to Seattle, she's about 30 when she comes to live with her father, Sidney. He was now the pastor at Queen Anne's Congregational Church, so there's another Seattle connection. And see, this is one of the areas where I think you could see it's really apparent that her radicalism is starting to show, right? Because in saying that she thinks that in 1916 for the school board that the school should serve this broader vision than just educating, but being community centers and providing services, and also in the traveling exhibit that she's doing to try to reveal the effects of poverty, she's really seeing that poverty is a structural problem with society. It's a symptom, not a disease. And that's really kind of a radical diagnosis. She's not seeing it as a one-off problem, or she's not blaming the parents of the children. It's not the poor people's fault. She's seeing this as a social diagnosis. So back to her being on the school board, this will kind of get into her involvement with labor. She's elected to the school board in 1916, and labor history buffs out there might remember 1916 is another significant year in Pacific Northwest labor history. It's the year of the Everett Massacre. And so the Everett Massacre is an attempt by the industrial workers of the world to support a striking shingle weavers union in Everett, Washington, against the lumber owners. They keep trying to organize, get repressed by the sheriff. Eventually, there's a showdown as they try to stage one of their famous free speech fights, saying that they have the right to make speeches and not be curtailed or beaten, which had been happening by the business owners and the
Yeah, it's hard sheriff. To speak when you're being beaten.
Right, yes. So there's this showdown that happens when a couple ships try to land at Everett's municipal dock. There's a bunch of gunfire. At least 12 Wobblies, the Industrial Workers of the World members, that's their nickname, are killed, but they only recover 5 bodies. And there's a couple sheriff's deputies that get shot by friendly fire. And so there's this big showdown, and the Wobblies are rounded up, and there's this trial, and they're all going to be arrested and put on trial. And so Strong actually starts at this point writing for the New York Evening Post on the event. And at first, she's pretty neutral, right? But the more she finds out about it, the more she realizes that she thinks that the IWW members, the Wobblies, got an unfair deal. And she begins to integrate that argument into her articles. Now, this does not ingratiate her to her fellow school board members who were mostly or often pro-World War. This is right in the lead up to World War I, you got to remember. So there's a lot of people, especially veterans of the Spanish-American War, who advocate the U.S.'s entry into the war. So she's now a pacifist. She's pro-Wobbly. But basically, the opposition of the war by the Wobblies led to these mass arrests at their Seattle office, including their typist, who had mailed and mimeographed a bunch of flyers to draftees, urging them to be conscientious objectors, right? And Strong actually is at his side in court to support him as he's tried for sedition and he's found guilty and sent to prison. So all this sort of paints a picture of why Strong's fellow school board members launched a recall campaign against her, and they won by a narrow margin. So you see that there's these intersections. You asked what her involvement with labor was. Well, she's interested in these social issues. She sees some of her philosophy reflected in organizations like the Industrial Workers of the World. She becomes involved with them in solidarity, first with the Everett Massacre and also in pacifism opposing World War I. Mm-hmm. And you could see her growing class consciousness is happening, which kind of positions her for the next thing, which is her involvement in the Seattle General Strike in 1919.
And what was her role in the Seattle Strike of 1919?
Well, at this point, Strong is actually writing for Seattle's only labor paper, the Union Record. And she's writing these really forceful pro-labor articles, which are promoting militant labor organizing. She's also promoting the new Soviet government. And she's also writing other articles, kind of interestingly, under a pseudonym. She's writing poems about socialism. And she's also writing an advice column for socialist middle-class women. And and she gains notoriety here because she pens this really famous front-page editorial during the general strike in 19 that seemed to call for revolution. It's called No One Knows Where, right? And she proclaims in this editorial, "We are undertaking the most tremendous move ever made by labor in this country, a move which will lead no one knows where," right? So a lot of people, especially centrists, completely freak out because they think that she's calling for a Soviet of Seattle and a takeover. It's not clear if that's exactly what she was doing. It seems likely because she was definitely a radical later in life. But most importantly, she's saying that she's in solidarity with the workers. She also serves as a member of this general strike committee during the event. And I should probably backtrack and explain what the Seattle general strike is.
That'd be good.
Okay. So a general strike itself is when all workers in a particular geographic region decide that they're going to quit work, usually as a show of force to try to get demands, to try to protest something. Sometimes it's better labor conditions, sometimes it's to protest treatment by the government or employers. And it means that in a geographic location like Seattle, basically most workers that are part of organized labor unions and maybe some other ones shut down. And so indeed in Seattle in 1919, there was this big shipyard worker strike and there was back and forth and there was some government involvement and an intractability of the employers which refused to negotiate because there was a wage freeze during World War I and then they wouldn't negotiate in good faith. And that shipyard strike actually grows to encompass the entire labor movement because the government seems to be trying to side with the employers in a very public way behind the scenes. And the workers decide they can't do this. So the city's labor council, which represents a bunch of trade unions, calls for a strike. And part of the way they run the strike is a general strike committee, which is a committee made up of a bunch of workers. And so Strong actually serves as a member of that governance committee during the course of the strike, which lasts 4 days and shuts down Seattle.
She was a very active woman. So what would you say were her major contributions to the labor movement?
Well, the reason I thought it would be interesting to talk about her is that I think that in and of herself, right, her being a journalist and her writing about labor causes and her being an advocate for labor causes, that in itself is already an important contribution to labor history, particularly Seattle's. She's on the school board with labor support. She's advocating working class issues. That's important. But also, I think I chose to talk about her because she really reminds us that women have always played this important role as workers, right? They've always played impactful roles in the labor movement, and their stories aren't really recorded in that same way in proportion to their contributions. And so the other thing that's interesting about her is her labor activism is really part of this progressive era coalition, right? And the progressive era, just to remind everybody, is this era between 1890 and 1920, where there are these social experiments within the United States. There's growing tension from mostly middle-class reformers that they see all these new people who are very poor and impoverished by industrial jobs, immigrants who are being exploited by a rapidly growing industry in an industrializing nation. And then at the other hand, there's these really rich industrialists and owners and capitalists who are getting disproportionately rich. And there's very little by way of legislation to try to regulate this disparity in income and power, which might sound familiar to some people because it's a lot similar to what's going on today. And so these educated core of middle-class people become these reformers and advocates. Strong is really interesting in that she comes from a middle-class background. She is advantaged. She's somebody who's from a very educated family, and she actually has the wherewithal to even get a PhD, right? So she's one of these people who's an advocate, and she's elected to the school board by that kind of a coalition of women's clubs and organized labor. And I think it reminds us that the labor movement is often properly not necessarily remembered, that a lot of these progressive era reforms like the end of child labor or protective legislation or the 8-hour day, these things are advocated by the labor movement and they become rolled into these progressive era reform coalitions. So in a sense, that's another contribution of her to the labor movement. And then of course, as she radicalizes, she eventually goes to Russia because she's kind of disheartened by the collapse of the Seattle general strike. There's some divisions in terms of politics and the labor movement. She wants to see Russia in the wake of the revolution. And she eventually does go there and becomes a journalist and travels extensively in there and in other countries abroad, including Asia. She eventually is in China and becomes friends with Mao, actually. And I think that from her perspective, probably her seeing these socialist forms of government is really an extension of her supporting social reform, fundamental change of the social system, and seeing labor being in charge, because from her perspective, probably it means that workers governing the apparatus of the state is part of a much broader labor movement, right? So she's sort of allying herself with Russia and then China later. And I think that shows that she's being a labor advocate in that sense, at least for herself later in life.
She is obviously an important character in the history of Northwest labor, and controversial as she may be, she did have an impact. So where do we find out more about her?
Well, the good news is, because she's famous, there's a lot of things that are written about her. Interestingly, she actually wrote a biography, an autobiography, called I Change Worlds in 1935, The Remaking of an American. So this is about her life up until that point. And actually, unfortunately, apparently she wrote another volume when she was older in China that hasn't made it out to see the light of day yet. And then, of course, my favorite thing is primary source collections, right? So we have the archives. Yeah. Believe it or not, the Labor Archives of Washington, by good coincidence and fortune, actually has the Anna Louise Strong papers. We got about 25 cubic feet of the stuff, so like copier paper boxes. And you can come and learn about her life and her through her own writings and correspondence. And then it related in special collections, UW special collections, we have the Strong family papers, Sidney Strong, her father's papers, correspondence with the radical Clayton Van Lidegraaff. And so you can see her correspondence with members of her family. Her father's collection is largely based around her because he was really proud of her and was collecting all of her writings as she toured through Russia and Asia and stuff like that as a correspondent. And then, of course, the Labor Archives portal on the UW Digital Collections website has now, first of all, we have hundreds of letters and writings, but we also digitized a bunch of writings and letters by Strong and correspondence between her and family members. So now you can go in there and look it up and really see that. And another primary source collection that's really interesting is the Anna Louise Strong archive at Marxist.org. So they got a bunch of primary sources of her writings. Other secondary sources, historical articles that use those primary sources as evidence, include this great documentary about her life called Witness to the Struggle. And then there was this great article on the Seattle Labor and Civil Rights Project website. It's the subsection is called Communism and Washington State History Project. And Rebecca Jackson wrote this great article about the politics of gender in the writings of Anna Louise Strong. So she does a much more critical analysis about the ways in which she wrote. That's how I knew about her writing from different perspectives in the Union Record. And then there's another subsection about a bio thing on that same project website. And of course, HistoryLink, which is a great source for Washington history, has an article about Anna Louise Strong as well.
Thanks again, Connor, for bringing to life Anna Louise Strong, who made a difference in the lives of all workers. And also thank you for your dedication to a profession that enables us to establish historical fact so that we can make better decisions today. And in this era of fake news and alternative facts and deliberate lies, it's vital that we preserve our real history.
When the boss comes around to cut your pay, your health care benefits fly away, and you feel like you just swallowed a pretty bitter pill. No time to moan or boo-hoo-hoo. Here's the thing that you should do. Listen to the words of old Joe Hill. Don't mourn, organize. Keep your eyes on the prize. Your strength in numbers and in size. Don't mourn, organize. When the governor says we no longer can fund your union's pension plan and sends the legislature that little bill, stand up straight, stand up tall. Can you say the word recall? Then recall the words of old Joe Hill. Don't mourn, organize. Keep your eyes on the prize. There's strength in numbers and and in size. Don't mourn, organize. Called to be singing the blues, 'cause they don't get it and they never will. Drown them out in union song, play it loud and proud and strong. Take a music lesson from old Joe Hill. Don't mourn, organize, keep your eyes on the prize. There's strength in numbers and in size. Don't mourn, organize. Don't mourn, organize. Keep your eyes on the prize. There's strength in numbers and in size. Don't mourn, organize. Don't mourn, organize.
Thank you for listening to We Do the Work. Please send your comments to ksvrwedothework@gmail.com. We Do the Work is a KSVR studio presentation made possible by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Our thanks to the late John Fromer, original composer, and Ann Feeney for our theme song We Do the Work from her CD Union Made. Remember, educate, agitate, mobilize, and organize.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City.
The count is down, the devil's in town, he's getting us one by one. We're losing ground, we're going down, each off on our own. Sparks will fly, good people will die, it's dark before the dawn. The fire will burn till we finally learn the way to gonna change the paradigm. On the streets and picket lines, every craft and every trade, break the chain, there's a world to gain. Man the barricades, as long as people of color are shot down in the street. Some sister or some brother chained in poverty, as long as they fill the jails with tales of hell and misery. At the very least, there'll be no peace till we finally see black, white, blue, and red. Like the IWW said, like a rainbow in the sky. Sound the bell, it's time to rebel. People, it's do or die. The water's bad, the cows are mad, grim reapers everywhere. On the farms and city homes, breathing poison air. No place to run, no place to hide, might as well get it right. The answer for this cancer is when we all unite. This planet's all we got. Let's give it our best shot for a better world in birth and in every land, protecting Mother Earth.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm your host, Chris Mann. Mike Stout wrote the song we've just heard, One Big Union. Mike is not only a musician, but a relentless union and social justice activist from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Mike wrote the book, Homestead Steel Mill, The Final 10 Years. This is the actual tale of Local 1397 and the fight for union democracy. Mike was a crane operator in Homestead Steelworks. He later became grievance chair for the local, even serving after he was laid off. Welcome to the show, Mike. Can you briefly tell us about the significance of the mill that you worked in and the union?
Well, historically, the union originated out of the Amalgamation Association of Iron and Steel Workers back in the late 1880s. And by early 1890s, they represented the majority, if not all, of the craft workers at the Homestead Mill. And as crafts workers, maintenance workers, they pretty much controlled the entire workforce at Homestead. They believed in democracy. They believed they had a right to have a say in a lot of the things that unions and workers don't have a say in, whether it was investment rights, equipment, et cetera, et cetera. They imposed their self-discipline on the entire mill workforce, including those that weren't in the mill. Because of that, they were a direct threat to Andrew Carnegie and Henry Clay Frick and the people who ran the mill. The Battle of 1892 was one of the most famous battles in American history, worker struggles, where 700 Pinkertons attacked the town coming in on two boats, and the entire town rose up and resisted them. 10 people died, 300 Pinkertons were captured and held for 8 days until the National Guard state militia came and freed them and took back control of the town and crushed the union. And the union was crushed, but never went away. There was numerous attempts between 1892 and the 1920s to reestablish the amalgamated, which failed. Then, of course, the big strike came in 1919 when, once again, the unions tried to organize the steelworkers, this time the entire workforce. And once again, it was crushed, not only by the government, but by the iron and coal police and hired thugs and guns, and stay that way until the 1930s and the New Deal. And once again, the steelworkers rose up and formed the Steelworkers Organizing Committee, and the rest was history.
You write, most of all, this book is about steelworker local union is a working class hymn to democracy and solidarity, about the time when the bottom rose up to the brim, when the democracy was from below more than just words. Would you apply this statement to our current movements today, such as Black Lives Matter, that it is a rise from the bottom to the top?
Yes, that's exactly where all democratic movements come from. I've never seen a democratic movement in history that came from the top. It comes from the people that are affected and the people that are fighting in the trenches and the people that are in the workplaces. And that's certainly what happened at the Homestead Steel Mill in the mid-1970s.
So why did you write this book?
I wrote this book for three reasons. Number one, the vast majority of the population in the United States, including the majority of workers, have never been in a union, don't know anything about unions, and what they have heard about unions is utter BS. And I think it was important to establish my personal history and direct history with unions inside a steel mill, and why unions were necessary then and why their unions are necessary today. And not only why unions are necessary, but what unions should look like. And by that, there's always been two forms out there. There's the business style unionism, and there's what we call democracy solidarity unionism. And when I entered the Homestead Mill, the situation was, it was a business union, and it was a very bad business union. They didn't even do their business. That workers had virtually no representation, paid dues for nothing, and a small group of people got together and decided to do something about it.
Tell us about the newspaper, the plant-wide newspaper, the 1397 rank and file.
The newspaper, in my opinion, was to this day the most progressive democratic expression inside a union that I've ever seen or read about. And it was started by a young woman who was only 24 years old named Michelle McMills. And back in the 1970s, she was in a man's world. She was in a macho man's steel world. And for a 24-year-old woman to go into that world and do what she accomplished, in my opinion, she was up there with Mother Jones.
That's all the time we have for tonight. There's so much that unionists can glean from this book written by Mike Stout, Homestead Steel Mill, The Final 10 Years, that we've asked Mike to return for a show in March.
Manage the conditions where you've come from to struggle and fight for the common man's rights to be. Good enough for me.
the Workers' Beat Extra. Today, I've cornered historian Max Krockmal. And I want to talk to you, Max, about what's wrong with labor. Why is it that people don't know anything about labor history nowadays?
Sure. Thank you for having me, Gene. It's always great to be with the Workers' Beat. So yeah, we talked a little bit beforehand. They're interrelated questions, right? There's the one question is, why do people not know U.S. labor history? And then I think to the extent that we do know U.S. labor history, we tend to romanticize it and oversimplify it. And so the other question is, where did labor go wrong? What can we learn from the past and actually help steer the movement in a more progressive direction today? So to take the first part, why don't we know more about this? We say history is written by the victors. And the victors in the class conflict are unquestionably the capitalists. And the mainstream tellings we have of history, not necessarily just in schools, but more broadly in our culture, are funded by the very same corporations that benefit from keeping workers powerless. And so that's problem number one. Within that broad framework, there are lots of great books out there. There's generations of labor historians who have recovered different parts of the past of working class struggle, including working class victories. We've learned a lot about the possibilities and promise of the labor movement and of other social movements. And so the stories are out there, and in many cases, they have been held onto or reconstructed from fragmentary sources. But we have to keep working on getting that story told to a larger reading public. And we have some of the classics of U.S. social history, like the People's History of the United States by Zinn, but I think folks tend to not see organized labor as a central force in progress in American history.
And that's basically because the employers are the ones that control all the publishing houses and the TV stations and the newspapers and everything else.
And beyond that, to the movies, the fictional movies that are made and the textbook standards that are written and everything else. But yeah, go ahead. What do you got there?
This is a fine book that will stand up well to criticism. It's Blue Texas by Max Krockmal. And I want to thank you for having presented this book, because Texas history is a fraud for the most part.
Yeah.
It's really very hard to read Texas history if you have any idea what really happened. Someone called my radio station just the other day and was celebrating the Texas War for Independence. And I mentioned that, yeah, and they instituted the worst slavery laws in America on their first day. And he said, oh, no, that really wasn't much of a part of it. And I thought to myself, this guy doesn't know any Texas history at all.
Yeah, for sure. The origins of Texas had everything to do with slavery. And that, by the way, is a working class history. That the people who came, the Anglos who came and migrated here, even after Mexico had barred them from migrating, they came illegally. And they came to bring slaves, and they seceded from Mexico in order to work enslaved people to the death, to the bone, and extract profits from adding Texas to the Cotton Empire. And so yeah, it goes way back.
And I believe it's true that they had the worst anti-Black codes in the South, worse than anybody. Free Black was not even allowed in Texas under the original, when they first put their constitution together.
Yeah.
So that's one of the problems that you brought up, that people don't know about labor history, and it's basically because the employers control all the information sources. What's the other thing?
Well, okay, we were talking about where did the labor movement go wrong? And so maybe just to back up, I think that there's a lot of different overlapping issues. And just in talking about slavery as a labor system, I think most union members, most workers today, if you ask them about the history of labor, they would think that those kinds of stories, right, about enslavement and about resistance on the plantations and about struggles against racism, that those were not the real center thrust of labor history, when in fact they very much are. So that's one issue, is just where do we define it? To take another example, in Texas in the 1880s and 90s, there was a mass movement of farmers, of small farmers, right, who organized first a huge network of cooperatives, and ultimately a political party, right, which merged with other groups around the country to become the People's Party, the Populists. And in Texas, it was, in much of the South, it was biracial. There was another all-Black, at the time they said colored farmers alliance, that brought together small farmers and even sharecroppers, tenant farmers, in this mass movement in which they directly confronted the railroads and the banks that were controlling their livelihoods. And again, that to me is another example of labor history we don't often talk about.
Yeah, hardly.
But then if we get to the 20th century, there's much more. But yeah, go ahead.
The People's Party is hardly even mentioned in any history of Texas. And yet, I think the building where they had their meeting in downtown Dallas, I think the building is still there. It's a furniture warehouse.
But yeah,
the People's Party was very big.
Yeah, I mean, look up the Cleburne demands, right? The opening salvo of the Southern Alliance movement. And it's some radical stuff in there. And they called for the nationalization of the entire transportation and communication systems in the nation. It's akin to today we declared interstate trucking and the airlines public institutions and took over the internet and said it was going to be a public utility rather than a bunch of private businesses. They had some really stark ideas. And at the root of it was that they believed in cooperation and in democracy, which the idea were still concepts that were viable before capitalism came and crushed it.
I've met people from Cleburne. A lot of people from Cleburne worked in my plant, and they hadn't the slightest idea that the People's Party was started there in Cleburne.
Yeah, we need to put up a marker or something. It's important history.
That would be great.
Although I don't know if we could ever get the Johnson County Commission to sign off on that. But we do have a separate and independent world of labor history that really took on new force beginning with the kind of the rise of the new social movements in the 60s and 70s. In fact, there was a field called the New Labor History. And one of the leading practitioners still today and a great early author named Nelson Lichtenstein has written a lot about the Ruthers, right, to take that example. And so what Nelson did in his first book, Labor's War at Home, and then a later book, Biography of Walter Ruther, when the title of that book is The Most Dangerous Man in Detroit. And he plays with that because on the one hand, that's what the industrialists called Ruther for challenging their authority and their control over the city and of the industry. But he also shows in those early works the ways in which Ruther pivots by the end of soon after the war to embracing virulent anti-communism. He was never pro-communist, but he was somewhat more neutral in the early days, and embracing American empire. And so Ruther makes the shift from in 1946 asking for General Motors to open the books and to make the company essentially controlled by workers, right, in a German-style model, you know, what we might think of now. He goes from saying, open the books, and we want a bigger piece of the pie, to instead accepting labor management peace, accepting the imperative for labor leaders to limit shop floor militancy, and accepting ultimately the Treaty of Detroit in 1950, a five-year contract with a bunch of benefits and pensions and everything else and good wage scales. And he says that rather than a bigger piece of the pie, the United Auto Workers need to seek out a bigger pie. And that means that they have to collaborate with management and with U.S. empire, including extending those markets through the Cold War and ultimately, right, through nefarious partnerships with the CIA and beyond. So that's been pretty documented now. There were a bunch of rank and file labor union members going back to the 80s and even the later 70s that started to uncover and expose the depth of CIA labor collaboration. Starting one famous example, of course, is the coup against Allende in Chile in 1973. But that was revealed just a few years later. And now folks in my field of professional historians have started to write those books as well. But right, I think organized labor to this day, I think, has the ongoing question of how is it going to relate to America's imperial ambitions and America's sense of exceptionalism. And I think what if we learned anything from the last several decades since, say, NAFTA, or of course, globalization started before that, it's that the working people of the United States are not going to prosper at the expense of the working people of the rest of the world. That's not a long-term strategy. So they're going to need to find a different route.
You mentioned the Treaty of Detroit. Really, that's a generic term because it covers several union contracts that were signed around that time, primarily by the United Auto Workers. But is it not true that it was in that period, in those contracts, that the United States a labor movement gave up on national health care and gave up on strengthening Social Security and instead took employer-provided pensions and employer-provided health care, which tended to leave the rest of the working class behind and just, in other words, they just got things for their own members and stopped representing all the workers.
Yeah, that's correct. That was part of the treaty from labor's vantage point, was that they secured those benefits and they could focus on other things. And they did leave behind the rest of the working class. And I think we can look a little further back in terms of why that decision came to be. If we look at the first years of the Great Depression, there were widespread working class movements that were outside of the House of Labor, right? There were unemployed councils. There was the Workers' Alliance of America. Both of those groups were communist affiliated, but there was a whole bunch of local movements in which working people came together to demand relief, to demand public welfare, saying that the private charities were not sufficient. And with the election of FDR, there was, you know, a tremendous amount of optimism that was going to take place, and to a great extent it did. But of course, the system, the welfare state that the New Dealers created was bifurcated. There were people who were let into it and people who were excluded from it. And the people let in were white male industrial workers and folks who were becoming white, European, second wave, new European immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe whose whiteness very much gets solidified by their inclusion in the New Deal state. And then there's categorical exclusions of domestic workers, of agricultural workers, the folks who we still sometimes today forget about when we talk about labor history. But what that meant was that over 80% of Black women were excluded from the key provisions of the New Deal. And that included the Wagner Act, and it included the Social Security Act, mm-hmm. and a bunch of other provisions. And that combined with, over time, the shift in, you know, toward a more commercial approach to economic recovery through the housing market and other places, we end up seeing eventually Taft-Hartley, which takes what little bit of good labor law there was and turns it against the workers who were covered by it.
That was the law that was passed in 1947 that kind of set the path of destruction for American labor movement.
Yeah, to some extent. Yeah, sure. It takes the Wagner Act and it turns it against working people. It bars the secondary boycott. It bars the sympathy strike. It limits the sit-down strike. It excludes communists from labor's ranks, some of the best organizers that were out there. And it also creates right to work as an option.
A closed shop.
Yeah.
So the unions could never again claim the dues from all the members that they represent.
Well, and fundamentally control the hiring process as mm-hmm. well. But yeah, to get to your question, so in that context, the United Auto Workers, the brothers Ruther, they do turn against the communists in their ranks and against many of the civil rights activists, Black and white, in their ranks. They consolidate control over the union. They negotiate this treaty with GM and the other big automakers that becomes the pattern for the industry and indeed for all of basic industry. And they embrace what we've called a public-private welfare state, a hybrid sense of provision, so that, yeah, their members get the benefits, their members get the health care, the pensions. But they, even as they, I think they did fight for the expansion of U.S. liberalism, those particular issues were not foregrounded. And we've definitely seen that come back to bite working people, right? When after the 70s and 80s hit and companies start automating more, offshoring more, or the runaway plants and everything else that we collectively put into the idea of deindustrialization, and suddenly there's no basis for those private welfare provisions and there's no public alternative. And here we are all these years later, and we're still arguing about whether we can have a public option or Medicare for all. And so clearly that would do a lot to help working people.
Well, as we get toward winding this up, I want to take back everything else I said, because we've been looking at what's wrong. I said, I deliberately asked you to speak on what's wrong. And we've pointed out some things that we think could be better. But to my radical young friends of today, I want to say this. There are basically two armies in the world. One is the employers, and the other one is our side, the employees, the people who have to work for a living. And we may not agree with our generals and our colonels and our brass and our officers on our side, but that's still our army. We're still on that side. And even though we may have some criticisms, the overall aspects of struggle today will not benefit by divisions. We will have to pull together. First of all, we have to recognize what side we're on. And then we have to apply ourselves to our side and not just play the boss's game by standing aside and criticizing. And because of that, I want to bring up your book again, because in fact, even in this period that we've talked about in which labor made a lot of mistakes, there were people, and you wrote about them, who were doing a fabulous job and who were valiant beyond all measure, put their lives on the line right here in Texas. It's in the book Blue Texas by Max Krochmal, and I recommend it to everyone.
Thanks, Gene. Yeah, and I think that's a good point. I would say another big part of the labor history story is that it's very much focused still on those northern industrial workers in the Snow Belt, right? The Michigan story becomes, or the Pennsylvania story becomes, the national story. And in fact, if you look beyond that industrial heartland, workers all over America and beyond, but throughout the United States, have long turned to unions as a way to try to improve their condition, right? Along with other forms of mutual aid societies and self-help organizations, community organizations, neighborhoods, civil rights groups. And labor has represented a really important tool for justice struggles for people who have been able to, you know, carve out space within the labor movement to do that. And even the institutional forms of labor. So in my book, I write about the Texas AFL-CIO that in the 1960s very much committed itself to actually doing what you were talking about, recognizing some of their past wrongs and making some really big adjustments. And in their case, that meant understanding that they had soft-pedaled the race issue for too long, that they had accepted segregation of the work site and of their unions and of their communities, and that they needed to change that in order to advance the labor movement, as well as for humanitarian and ethical moral reasons. And so they did. And in the 1960s, they really did put their money where their mouth was and invest in organizing workers of color, invest in forming political coalitions with civil rights groups, and really prioritizing the issues of civil rights groups, both Black and Mexican American. And so I think that's a wonderful model and starting point for us to think about what does it look like to build progressive coalitions in our cities and in our state today. Organized labor is still there, and there's still some big work sites that and big important struggles happening in those places. And they're largely cut off, right, from the work that people are doing, say, for police accountability or for immigrant rights. We aren't talking to each other as much as we need to be and educating each other enough about what those different struggles are. And I think that one of the main points of the book is that doing that work, collaborating and building coalitions with folks who aren't like you, doesn't mean that you have to give up your independence and your autonomy, but rather that by understanding and putting those differences on the table, we're able to actually communicate about them and build new alliances and build power for all working people. And that a key ingredient to that is that the most secure workers, and usually means white workers, do need to take a bit of a back seat and try to understand the struggle as it looks to people of color, and to really put those issues and priorities first.
Building progressive coalitions is the task before us. And people should recognize that organized labor can be the core of those progressive coalitions, certainly can be an important part of every progressive coalition. Organized labor needs to change, maybe to some extent, but so does everybody else if we're going to develop the kind of power that we need to face the future. Thanks so much. I've talked to Max Krochmal, history professor in Fort Worth, Texas. And thank you very much, Max. This is Gene Lance on the Workers' Beat Extra.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2006. That was the day 7,000 teachers and staff at the Orleans Parish School District in New Orleans, Louisiana, were fired. The public schools were considered some of the worst in the country. The school district was also bankrupt. It was unable to account for $71 million in federal funds. After Hurricane Katrina, the school district lost nearly its entire tax base. The district canceled all pay and health insurance for its teachers and staff. Then, the state of Louisiana seized control of most of the city's 128 schools. A majority were either closed or turned over to charter school operators. The school district fired its remaining teachers and staff. It was a union-busting maneuver against the United Teachers of New Orleans. The union was an AFT affiliate. Organized in 1972, it was the first first integrated education union in the South. Its membership overwhelmingly consisted of African American women. After the schools were turned over to the charters, they were replaced by inexperienced Teach for America workers. Many of these new teachers did not have any teacher certification. A class action lawsuit soon followed. In 2014, Louisiana's Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals found that teachers and staff were not given due process and had the right to be rehired as schools reopened after Katrina. The damages could amount to $1.5 billion. 10 years after Katrina, a New York Times article asked the question, was Hurricane Katrina the best thing ever to happen to the education system in New Orleans? As Education Secretary Arne Duncan once said, the answer has been a resounding no. In the years since, the union has fought successfully to organize many of the charter schools in New Orleans. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I was born at Saddle Bay Bridge. I grew up in the cold, rusty east. The daddy ran a tavern there up by Pistol Bay.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. And if you like what you hear, and we hope you do, please like it in your podcast app and pass it along. Today's music includes Nothing Moves But the Tide from the rock opera Seattle 1919, recorded by The Fuse in 1985, composed by Rob Rosenthal and produced by Rosenthal and Mike Rawson. The album tells the story of a young Midwesterner who rides the rails to Seattle looking for work in the World War I shipyards. He gets involved in working class Seattle, meeting gamblers, sailors, and wobblies, developing a friendship with Anna Louise Strong, and joining in the 1919 general strike that shuts down the shipyards and the city. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to more than 80 labor radio and podcast shows. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdat. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.
Except for the wagons bearing the sign, exempt by the strike committee. And the strike committee, yes, my friends, that's no one but you and me.